Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Did you know you can get Democracy Now!'s headlines and stories delivered directly to your inbox every day? Just text Democracy Now!, one word, no space. Text Democracy Now! To 66866 to subscribe to our daily digest, and you'll never miss a story. Once again, Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. Thanks so much, and stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
When President Biden arrived to the White House, he promised that he will lift the sanctions as soon as he arrived. And so far, 6 months later, he has done nothing.
After rare anti-government protests in Cuba, Cuban Americans are speaking out to demand the U.S. government end its blockade of the island. But President Biden's responded with new sanctions. We'll speak with Cuban-American Carlos Lazo, who just led a march from Miami to the White House, and with historian William Leo Grand, who writes in The Nation, now is the time for Biden to restaff the Havana embassy. Then, as the United States imposes new Cuba sanctions citing human rights abuses, we'll look at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Abdel-Latif Nasser was released from Guantanamo Bay last week after 19 years of detention without charge or trial. And while we are thrilled that Abdel-Latif is back with his family, Guantanamo Bay remains open and still houses 39 men, 28 of whom have never been charged with a crime, let alone face trial.
We'll speak with a lawyer for Abdel-Latif Nasser, who was just released from Guantanamo to Morocco, and the lawyer for former Guantanamo prisoner Ravil Mingazov, who's currently being held in a UAE prison after being released from Guantanamo in 2017, where he was held without charge for 15 years.
Guantanamo has been a giant mistake. What we need to talk about is when will Guantanamo finally close? And also, what's happening in the United Arab Emirates, the Guantanamo of the East?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The state of California and New York City have announced plans to require government workers get vaccinated or face weekly COVID-19 tests. These new initiatives come as the number of new COVID cases has quadrupled in the United States over the past month and are expected to keep rising for months as the highly contagious Delta variant continues to spread, particularly in areas with low vaccination rates. On Monday, the Department of Veterans Affairs became the first federal agency to require its frontline healthcare workers to get vaccinated. The American Medical Association and American Nurses Association have also joined with other medical groups calling for mandatory vaccination of all healthcare workers. In a statement, the group said, quote, the health and safety of U.S. workers, families, communities, and the nation depends on it, unquote. According to the CDC, every county in Florida and Arkansas now has high levels of community transmission. Florida accounts for nearly 1 in 5 of all new COVID cases in the country. The virus is also spreading rapidly across Missouri, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Meanwhile, a new study out of UCLA finds the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths both increased dramatically after states lifted eviction moratoria. The study estimates over 10,000 lives could have been saved if the moratoria were left in place. In international news, COVID-19 cases are surging in Tokyo as it hosts the Summer Olympics. The city reported over 2,800 new infections today, the highest since the start of the pandemic. At least 155 people tied to the Olympic Games have now tested positive for COVID. Meanwhile, Iran is also reporting record-breaking COVID infections. Nearly 32,000 new cases were registered in the past 24 hours, and at least 322 new deaths overnight, the highest since at least May. Protesters have been gathering outside the Tunisian parliament to denounce President Kais Saied after he ousted the prime minister and suspended parliament. On Monday, the Tunisian president ordered a nightly curfew and dismissed the nation's defense minister and acting justice minister. Tunisian police have also raided the offices of Al Jazeera in Tunis. Critics have accused the Tunisian president of launching a coup d'etat.
The decisions by President Kais Saied are not correct, against the constitution and the reality. They bring us back again to 1954. The scene of the parliament closed by tanks is very disgraceful.
10 years ago, Tunisia became the birthplace of the Arab Spring. President Biden and Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami have signed an agreement to formally end the U.S. combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year, more than 18 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. But the agreement is largely symbolic, as the U.S. will keep troops in Iraq indefinitely in an advisory role, Biden spoke Monday.
I think things are going well. Our role in Iraq will be as a dealing with not, it's just to be available to continue to train, to assist, to help, and to deal with ISIS as it arrives. But we are not going to be by the end of the year in a combat mission.
57 people are feared dead after a boat capsized off the coast of Libya. Many of the passengers were migrants from Nigeria, Ghana, and Gambia. The number of refugees who've died while attempting to reach European soil by sea has more than doubled compared to the first 6 months of 2020. So far this year, over 1,100 people have perished. Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of carrying out apparent war crimes during its recent 11-day assault on Gaza that killed 260 Palestinians, including at least 66 children. In a new report, Human Rights Watch called on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's crimes against Palestinian civilians. Survivors who spoke to Human Rights Watch include Omar Abu Alouf, who lost his father, mother, and two siblings when their four-story building collapsed in Gaza City following Israeli airstrikes.
Why did they kill my family? Why did they kill my father and mother? Why did they turn me into an orphan? Who will, in the end, give me justice?
Omar Abu Alouf's father was the head of the internal medicine at Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital, where he headed the hospital's coronavirus response. Human Rights Watch also accused Palestinian armed groups of committing unlawful acts by indiscriminately firing rockets at Israel. One of Lebanon's wealthiest business executives has been named prime minister designate. The billionaire Najib Mikati has served twice before as prime minister. Lebanon is in the midst of a massive economic and political crisis. Mikati has been accused of corruption in the past. In 2019, a public prosecutor brought charges against him for profiting from state-subsidized housing loans. A top Chinese diplomat has accused the Biden administration of demonizing China. During face-to-face talks in Beijing with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, China's vice foreign minister urged the U.S. to, quote, change its highly misguided mindset and dangerous policy. In related news, the U.S. Air Force is sending more than two dozen F-22 stealth fighter jets and 10 F-15 Strike Eagle fighters to a U.S. base on Guam as tensions escalate between the United States and China. In the Philippines, police shot dead two activists Monday who were spray-painting the words "Aus Duterte" on public property ahead of President Rodrigo Duterte's State of the Nation address. The Philippines-based rights group Defend Bicol condemned the killing, saying, quote, "Dissent may take on many forms, but to kill innocent unarmed civilians in the dead of the night for painting the people's call is purely fascist and brutal," they said. Rights groups estimate there have been over 400 extrajudicial killings since Duterte took office. Thousands have been killed since Duterte unleashed a brutal so-called war on drugs. Authorities in Haiti have arrested the head of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's security team as part of its probe into Moïse's assassination on July 7th. It remains unclear how Moïse's assassins were able to get by the president's security detail without firing a shot. Haitian authorities have also issued an arrest warrant for Supreme Court Justice Wendell Coctelot. Her whereabouts are unknown. Meanwhile, CNN is reporting some of the court clerks involved in the investigation of Moïse's assassination have received multiple death threats. In Nicaragua, another presidential candidate has been arrested as President Daniel Ortega continues to crack down on his opposition ahead of the November election. At least seven presidential hopefuls have been apprehended since June. Almost two dozen journalists and opposition activists have also been detained under a treason law. Ortega has long justified the arrest, saying he's only targeting people suspected of planning a coup against his government. On Monday, Ortega accused the U.S. government of trying to undermine the political process in Nicaragua.
The Yankees have no respect. For them, elections are only valid when their weaklings win, who they put up as candidates. So if the U.S. allies win, the election is good. If their weaklings don't win, then the election is bad, and they do everything possible to destabilize the country, to destroy the country.
In Bangladesh, torrential rain has caused widespread flooding in Cox's Bazar, the world's largest refugee camp. It houses nearly 900,000 Rohingya refugees who fled violence and persecution in Burma. At least five refugees have died in landslides. A child was also killed after being swept away by flooding. Several others were injured. This comes as COVID-19 cases are spiking in Bangladesh. On Monday, the government recorded over 15,000 new infections and nearly 250 deaths, both the highest one-day totals since the pandemic began. Here in the United States, more than 1.5 million acres of land have now burned as firefighters battle at least 85 active wildfires across the West. In Oregon, the bootleg fire has burned over 400,000 acres. The Dixie fire is now threatening 10,000 homes in California. Meanwhile, Lake Powell, the second largest reservoir in the United States, has reached a record low amidst a massive climate change-fueled drought in the West. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, more than 90% of the West is now officially in drought. In immigration news, the Biden administration's announced plans to place some migrant families arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border in expedited removal proceedings. The practice allows U.S. immigration officials to deport people without a court hearing in front of an immigration judge. Advocates warn the policy is a violation of due process and international law. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol will hold its first hearing today and hear testimony from four police officers who were attacked by Trump supporters while defending the Capitol. The committee is made up of seven Democrats and two Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, both of whom voted to impeach Trump for his role instigating the assault on the Capitol. Last week, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy pulled all of his recommended committee members after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi vetoed two of his five picks. On Monday, McCarthy chided Cheney and Kinzinger as, quote, Pelosi Republicans for participating in the probe. Trump advisor and longtime ally Tom Barrack pleaded not guilty Monday to charges of secretly lobbying for the United Arab Emirates. The lobbying came at a time when Barrack was making major business deals with the UAE and other Gulf states. The New York Times reported Barrack's real estate company received some $1.5 billion in investments from the UAE and Saudi Arabia after Trump's 2016 nomination. The billionaire investor was released last week on $250 million bond. He was chair of Trump's inauguration committee. In news from Canada, longtime Inuk leader Mary Simon has been sworn in as Canada's first Indigenous Governor General.
I am honored, humbled, and ready to be Canada's first Indigenous Governor General.
As Governor General, Mary Simon will serve as Queen Elizabeth's federal representative in Canada, as well as Commander-in-Chief of the Canadian Armed Forces. The Reverends Jesse Jackson and William Barber were arrested Monday, along with 37 others, during a sit-in at Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema's office in Phoenix, Arizona, calling on her to support ending the filibuster to help pass voting rights legislation. The Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign begin a 27-mile march for voting rights in Texas today. Organizers have described it as a, quote, Selma to Montgomery-style march. In labor news, workers at Frito-Lay in Kansas have ended a 19-day strike after the company agreed to a contract guaranteeing workers one day off per week. Workers went on strike to protest forced overtime, 84-hour workweeks, and horrific working conditions. In the summer, workers endured triple-digit temperatures without air conditioning. Multiple workers have reportedly died on the job of heart attacks. A federal judge has found environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger guilty of 6 counts of criminal contempt of court after he refused to turn over his computer and cell phone. The case stems from Chevron's unprecedented legal campaign against Donziger over his role in winning an $18 billion settlement against Chevron for dumping 16 billion gallons of oil into the Ecuadorian Amazon. In an unusual legal twist, the judge appointed a private law firm with ties to Chevron to prosecute Donziger after federal prosecutors declined to bring charges. Donziger, who has been under house arrest for almost 2 years, condemned the judge's ruling.
This is an outrageous decision. I see it as an attack on human rights lawyering, an attack on the very notion of corporate accountability for the fossil fuel industry. And I've already been locked up in my home awaiting this decision for almost 2 years on a misdemeanor. I'm the only lawyer in American history, as far as we can tell, who spent even 1 day prior to trial locked up. I've been here now 720 days. This is an outrage. It's a violation, I believe, of the rule of law. It's terrible for our democracy, and it's terrible for the planet. The United States cannot become a country that begins to lock up its human rights lawyers, its environmental advocates, its earth protectors.
Stephen Donziger has vowed to appeal Monday's ruling. To see our recent interview with Donziger, visit democracynow.org. And this update from the Tokyo Olympics, tennis superstar Naomi Osaka has been eliminated from the tennis tournament just days after lighting the Olympic cauldron during the opening ceremonies. She was playing for Japan after she gave up her U.S. citizenship. And four-time Olympic gold medal winner Simone Biles pulled out of the U.S. gymnastics team finals today with an apparent injury. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, after rare anti-government protests in Cuba, Cuban Americans are speaking out to demand the U.S. government end its blockade of the island. But President Biden has responded with new sanctions. He cites human rights abuses in Cuba. So we will speak not only with a Cuban American who just led a march from Miami to the White House, but also with lawyers for those who are imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. Stay with us.
Saca lo negro con boca la pala candela. Timba la conga pa' royal. Caramba pa' santía. Cachita mulata negra, carina.
Negra Caridad, Black Charity by Deme Aracena. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Cuba, which marked the 68th anniversary of the 1959 Cuban Revolution Monday after rare anti-government protests broke out on the island earlier this month, denouncing the economic crisis during the pandemic and reports of government repression. The shortage of resources comes after a decades-long U.S. embargo and catastrophic U.S. sanctions. Last week, the Biden administration imposed new sanctions on Cuba's defense minister and the interior ministry, with President Biden warning this is just the beginning. This comes as Mexico announced it'll send ships with food and medical supplies, including syringes, oxygen tanks and masks, to Cuba. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador addressed the U.S. Monday.
Rather than blocking, we should all help. It is not conceivable that in these times they want to punish an independent country with a blockade. I think that President Biden must make a decision about it. It is a respectful call from no point of view of interference, but we must separate the political from the humanitarian.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined foreign ministers from 20 countries in a statement Monday condemning the arrest of protesters in Cuba. And this comes as Cuban Americans and their supporters held dueling protests in Washington, D.C. in recent days. Some called for the U.S. to put more pressure on Cuba's government, while others condemned the U.S. blockade and support for protesters in Cuba. This is Code Pink's Medea Benjamin.
Why don't they come out and say they love the protesters in Colombia, or the protesters in Honduras, or the protesters in Haiti, or the protesters who get their heads chopped off in Saudi Arabia if they protest?
Medea Benjamin spoke at a protest outside the White House Sunday, along with members of the Puentes de Amor, or Bridges of Love Project, who marched 1,300 miles from Miami, Florida. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. to speak with one of the organizers. Carlos Lazo is a Cuban-American activist who led the march to D.C., meeting with people along the way. And we're joined by William Leo Grand, whose latest piece in The Nation with Peter Kornbluh is headlined, "Now is the time for Biden to restaff the Havana embassy." Leo Grand is co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and a professor of government in the School of Public Affairs at American University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Carlos Lazo, let's begin with you. You have just finished this massive march, 1,500 miles from Miami to Washington, D.C. Why?
Well, in 2020, President Trump imposed more sanctions to the Cuban people because during the pandemic. During that time, a year ago, we pedaled 3,000 miles from Seattle to Washington, D.C., asking President Trump to lift those sanctions, at least temporarily, because of the pandemic. We arrived to D.C. and President Trump did nothing. On the contrary, he imposed more sanctions. He even prevent the sending remittance through Western Union. But President Biden, at that time he was a candidate, he said that he would lift the sanctions on the families, that he will go back to the Obama policies. And we support President Biden during his campaign because we trust his word. And we find that after he got the presidency, he did nothing. After 7 months, he did nothing. He just postponed and postponed what he said, that he will relieve the Cuban families. And we get tired of waiting and waiting. And we decide to march from Washington, from Miami to Washington, D.C., to call the attention of the American people and to call the attention of everyone about how inhuman and unfair are these sanctions. And we depart from Miami on the 27th of June and arrive here on Sunday, the 25th of July.
And Carlos, I wanted to ask you, what was the reaction when you started the march in Miami? Who joined it, and what was the reception you got along the way?
Well, in Miami, we started the march after a caravan that Cuban Americans perform there every month, every end of the month. Every Sunday, we have a caravan, and so far, the caravan have 200, 300 people asking for the lifting of the sanctions to the Cuban people, to the Cuban families. Those caravans, unfortunately, are not reported in Miami, but they happen in the Calle 8, AS3. They happen every month. The reaction of the American people, and we met with people from different backgrounds, from Republicans, Democrats, African-Americans, Latinos, Anglos, everyone. And we didn't find one person who said that it was okay to blockade families. We didn't find one person that said that it was okay not allowing to send remittances during the pandemic. We didn't find just one person. We went through Florida. We stopped in different, walking in different cities. We went through Georgia. We talked to different people there, different organizations, Democrats, Republicans, as I said. And nobody, everybody agreed that the embargo should be lifted. And especially during the pandemic, a humanitarian perspective should be applied here. What was interesting about this trip that we did was that we were trying to educate the people about the blockade, about the embargo, and about how this mainly affect Cuban families and Cuban families in the United States, Cuban families in Cuba. But we find out that there are not just one blockade. Talking to those communities, we get also educated. We went to meet with African-American farmers in Georgia, and we learned about the lack of opportunities that they have, the lack of support with loans, the lack of government support. And we find out that there were more than one blockade, not just a blockade to Cuba, but many communities in the United States suffer also from a type of blockade, and we are joining forces here. We are learning from each other, and at the same time doing a common front to fight with all these inequities and injustices. And proof of that is the event that we had in front of the White House, the 25th of July, where Cuban Americans, Americans from all backgrounds, from many different organizations, join us asking President Biden to honor his war, leave the sanctions to the Cuban people.
I'd like to bring in William Leo Grand also. You're the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Could you talk about some of these secret negotiations that have gone on for decades in between the United States and Cuba? And also, I wanted to ask you a question, because we're going to be an additional question. Our next segment is going to be dealing with Guantanamo Bay and the Muslim prisoners that are still there. But a lot of Americans are not clear what is the legal basis for the United States still to have a base in Cuba, a country that it has a belligerent relationship now with for so long?
Well, let me start with the negotiations. Every president since Eisenhower has actually held some sort of negotiations with Cuba, the one exception being Donald Trump. But over the years, presidents of the United States, despite the relationship of hostility between the United States and Cuba, presidents of the United States have recognized that there are some issues that are important to the United States, and you can only make progress on them by talking to the Cubans, whether it's migration or counter-narcotics cooperation or getting to peace in Southern Africa and in Central America. And over the years, those negotiations have produced a lot of bilateral agreements that served U.S. interests. Just in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, after he began the process of trying to normalize relations with Cuba, Cuba and the United States signed 22 bilateral agreements on issues of mutual interest. And when Trump closed the door to relations with Cuba, there were 17 different negotiations underway to implement some of those agreements and to try to reach new ones. So there's a long history of negotiation and cooperation just under the surface of the very real hostility that the United States has had towards Cuba. Now, with regard to Guantanamo, when the United States intervened in Cuba in 1898, the Spanish-American War, one of the things that we forced Cuba to do in order to become an independent country was to sign something called the Platt Amendment, which gave the United States really what amounts to neo-colonial rights in Cuba. And one of those rights was naval bases. Guantanamo was one of those bases. And in 1933, We renegotiated a treaty with Cuba that gave us the right to stay in Guantanamo in perpetuity. Now, as you can imagine, after 1959, Fidel Castro demanded that we get out of Guantanamo and repudiated, abrogated that treaty, while the United States, of course, refused. And there was really no way that the Cubans could force us out, because obviously, if the Cuban government were to try to push Guantanamo or push the United States out of Guantanamo by force, that would give the United States an excuse to invade Cuba.
I mean, it's just an astounding story that here Biden is criticizing Cuba for human rights abuses, and then the U.S. is showing Cuba what respect for human rights would look like in Cuba, and the example being the Guantanamo prison, where 39 men are still being held, well, actually 37 around that right now. And we're going to talk with two lawyers for those men who were just released, held without charge for more than 15 years at Guantanamo. But I want to turn to Republican Senator Ted Cruz, whose father was Cuban-American, speaking to Fox Business, welcoming the Biden administration's pushback on the Cuban government.
I'm glad that the administration is announcing targeted sanctions on the Cuban regime. I think this is the least they could do, and then they're finally moving in the right direction.
So there you have President, you have Senator Cruz rarely complimenting President Biden. He joins with the with the Cuban-American senator, also Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, and Senator Rubio of Florida. Who is Biden trying to please, William Leo Grand? And why are you calling for the restaffing of the Havana embassy? What would that do?
Well, first, I think that the Biden administration is being or has been in its Cuba policy driven by domestic politics. And this, unfortunately, has been a problem for Democrats really for almost 30 or 40 years now. Ever since the end of the Cold War, Cuba has not been a very important foreign policy issue for the United States. But because of the power of the conservative Cuban-American lobby in South Florida, it has become a very important domestic political issue. As we know, Florida is always close in presidential elections. Most Cuban Americans are concentrated in South Florida, and so they become a really pivotal constituency in elections. The Democrats lost South Florida badly in 2020, and I think that's thrown the fear of God into the Biden administration. There are already some more conservative Democrats in the House and in the Senate who are urging Biden not to do anything to relax relations with Cuba, despite his campaign promises, for fear of losing even more ground in Florida in the 2022 midterm elections.
And the issue of restaffing the embassy, why this matters?
Well, it matters enormously. In 2017, Donald Trump reduced the U.S. Embassy staff and the Cuban Embassy staff here in Washington by about two-thirds, leaving really just a skeletal staffing. And one of the things that happened was that the consular section of the U.S. Embassy in Havana was closed to Cubans. And that meant that the United States was essentially violating the 1994 migration agreement that ended the famous rafters migration crisis during the Clinton administration. We had agreed at that time to end that crisis, to accept a minimum of 20,000 immigrant Cubans every year. And we'd been doing that ever since 1985. But the Trump administration simply ignored that agreement, closed the consular section, and the number of immigrant visas that we have given to Cubans during the Trump administration fell by 90%. What that means is that in the midst of this really terrible economic crisis in Cuba, Cubans have no safe and legal way to emigrate to the United States. The Cuban Family Reunification Program, which we use to reunify Cuban and Cuban-American families, was suspended by the Trump administration. So by restaffing the embassy and reopening the consular section, the Biden administration is taking an important step toward reopening safe and legal ways for Cubans to migrate so that they don't have to get on unseaworthy small boats and rickety rafts and risk their lives in the Florida Strait.
I wanted to bring Carlos Lasso back into the conversation. Could you talk a little bit about the practical ways that the sanctions affect daily Cuban life, and especially talk about the importance of remittances, the money that Cubans in the United States send back to their families? Because obviously throughout Latin America, not just in Cuba, the money, the remittances from Latino migrants in the United States are some of the biggest sources of foreign income to these countries, and greater than any U.S. aid to the countries.
Yes. Well, I want to go back to Professor Leo Grande about the closing of the embassy. And that's one of the ways that these sanctions affect the Cubans here and over there. People, in order to get a visa, if they get it, they have to travel to another country. It's almost impossible to get a visa. And if you do it, you have to spend a large amount of money. Also, the reunification program closed by Trump in 2017 that allowed an expedited way for Cuban Americans and for Cuban families to reunite, this was closed, and this affect Cuban families. The remittances. In October last year, President Trump prohibit Western Union to send money to Cuba. The source of income of the Cuban families, many people receive income from remittances. And by doing this, and it's just not to Cuba, to the United States, let me tell you, for a long time, if you live in another part of the world, you cannot send money to Cuba through Western Union because United States laws prohibit that. And they close the airports in all the provinces, meaning that they prohibit American airlines to fly to other airports other than Havana. This really affect Cuban families in the middle of a pandemic. There is no tourism in Cuba now because of the pandemic. And one of the main sources of income for the country is the tourism and also the remittances. If there is no tourism and there is no remittances, they end up empty-handed. They don't have a way to survive. I have, in my personal case, I have my aunt. She lives in Cuba for many years. I have support her. She is an old lady, and I send every month money to her through Western Union. And right now, it's almost impossible to do that. First of all, because there are no flights, because of the pandemic and all the restrictions. And the families are desperate. Hunger is happening in Havana, in Cuba, right now. And this brings me back to 1960. There was a memo written by a subsecretary of state, Marjorie, and he said at that time that the only way to get to overthrow the Cuban government was by creating hunger and desperation in the Cuban population. And then the Cuban population will rebel against that government. And it seems that this memo is happening today. It seems that the United States is in the pursuing, creating hunger and desperation in the Cuban people to achieve finally the overthrowing the Cuban government. The United States claims about the human right violation in Cuba, but I think that one of the biggest human right violations on Cuba happens because they blockade over 11 million families in Cuba, 11 million people.
Okay, and William Leo Grande, I wanted to ask you about this issue of the blockade. What do you think the recent statements by Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, very strong denunciation of the sanctions, and he also said, look, the rest of the world has been voting repeatedly to end these sanctions. It's time to actions, not just words. What do you think the impact of a figure like AMLO, a nation so close to the United States and so important to the United States might do?
Well, you know, Mexico never supported U.S. sanctions against Cuba, even when every other country in Latin America went along with OAS sanctions back in the 1960s. The Mexicans refused. You know, Mexico is obviously one of the most, if not the most important Latin American country to the United States. One would hope that this appeal by the Mexican president might be heard in the Biden administration. Particularly, I think it's appropriate because the way that President Obrador framed it was in terms of humanitarian assistance and the humanitarian need in Cuba today. And that need, as Carlos has said, is really extreme. And, you know, historically, the United States, even in the midst of our conflicts with Cuba, has been willing to provide humanitarian assistance to the island in situations of natural disasters, hurricanes, for example. Even George W. Bush, when he was president, offered Cuba humanitarian assistance after a terrible storm. So it's not unprecedented for the Biden administration to take some actions that would relax elements of the embargo, make it easier to ship medical equipment and supplies to Cuba, make it easier to send food to Cuba, make it easier to send remittances. Most importantly, Carlos is absolutely right about remittances. They are a critical component of the basic income of more than half of Cuban families. And with remittances largely cut off and with the tourism sector now shut down because of COVID, the Cuban government is essentially broke. They don't have the foreign exchange earnings to be able to import basic necessities like food and medicine and fuel. So there's a humanitarian crisis on the island. It's already increasing pressures for migration. And it would be in the interests not just of the Cuban people, but also in the interests of the United States for us to do something to relieve that misery.
I want to thank you both for being with us. William Leo Grand, author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. We'll also link to your piece with Peter Kornbluh in The Nation that you just wrote. Now is the time for Biden to restaff the Havana embassy. And thanks so much to Carlos Lasso. He is a Cuban-American activist with Puentes de Amor, or Bridges of Love, just completed this 1,500-mile march from Florida to Washington, D.C. Next up, as the United States imposes new Cuban sanctions, citing human rights abuses, we'll look at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo. Stay with us.
لا تنوشل أو تفتكر خبرية موت الملك كس مش الزجل لا نحتفل نطرق وص على شيد الحج كمن فرح كلبك سرح لام فلمات الزقل صار فيك تقول مات أخي ما ضل عالدرب وما ضل فيك تبادر تنتخي ضال للأبد ما ضل فيك تلبق ألوانك صار فيك تفرجينا سنانك فيك تقول أنا إلي أنا معي أنا ماني في تصر ما يتحدى بطلت الكلمة تربطها فيك الجسم ترفضها فيك تقول أنا مع أنا ضد ويلعن كل شي وكل حدا ناطر هتراك من سنين درويش وناصر الدين عموسي أمريدا زف الخبر لحلب وحمص والعين.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the United States imposes new Cuba sanctions, citing human rights abuses, we turn to look at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This month, the first Guantanamo prisoner to be released under the Biden administration returned to his home country of Morocco. 56-year-old Abdullatif Nasser was imprisoned for nearly two decades without charge and was cleared for release by the U.S. military since 2016. 39 prisoners remain at Guantanamo. This comes as activists gathered last week in front of the cultural attaché office for the United Arab Emirates in Washington, D.C., to protest the planned rendition of former Guantanamo prisoner Ravil Mengazov back to Russia. He's currently being held in a UAE prison after being released from Guantanamo in 2017, where he, too, was held without charge for 15 years. Advocates say 17 other former Guantanamo prisoners are now locked up in the UAE under inhumane conditions. This is Helen Schietinger of Witness Against Torture.
They've been tortured. These men will live with that for the rest of their lives. We owe them reparations. We need to make sure that they are in good situations and continue to follow them and support them in attempting to make the rest of their lives fulfilled.
For more, we're joined by two lawyers representing these men. Gary Thompson's an attorney in private practice who's worked on pro bono for Guantanamo prisoners. He's the lead attorney for former Guantanamo prisoner Ravil Mengazov. Also with us, Mark Mayer, staff attorney for Reprieve U.S., who's represented six men imprisoned at Guantanamo, including Abdul Latif Nasser, who was just released to Morocco. Mark, let's begin with you. Can you tell us the circumstances under which he was just released and what's happening to Abdul Latif Nasser now?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. So the circumstances under which he was released actually begin back in 2016. As you said, Abdul Latif Nasser was held for close to two decades, 19 years, without charge or trial. He was actually cleared for release by the Periodic Review Board, which is a parole-like institution that was set up under the Barack Obama's presidency and is staffed by six members of federal agencies from the United States, including the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They determined unanimously that Abdul Latif Nasser posed no threat to the United States or anybody and determined that he should be released from Guantanamo. Unfortunately, this determination came quite late in Barack Obama's presidency, and the State Department at that time deferred to the next administration, which, as we all know, was the Trump administration. President Trump had campaigned on the idea of not closing Guantanamo and, in fact, not transferring anyone out of Guantanamo, and largely kept to that promise. So even though Abdul Latif Nasser was cleared by senior civil servants from the U.S. government, he had to sit and wait until the political will within the United States changed. And as thrilled as we are that Abdul Latif Nasser is now out, that he is back in Morocco and is with his family and is trying to start a new life and is focused on the future, the fact remains that he lost close to two decades of his life, and that a number of men, 27 men, are still there without charge or trial, waiting for the political will of this administration to change as well.
And Mark Mayer, could you talk a little bit about how he came to end up in Guantanamo? How was he originally captured and transferred and detained there? And why did he never receive a trial?
Well, I can say that the reason why he never received a trial is the same reason why 27 of those men haven't received a trial either, and that's because they have never faced any kind of charges at all. They're being held essentially as prisoners of war. Abdul Latif Nasser ended up in Guantanamo the way a lot of people ended up in Guantanamo. There was a bounty program, essentially, that was being run in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, I believe. The number I might be getting wrong, but I believe what the bounties were being offered for turning over people to Afghan or American or Pakistani authorities was close to $5,000 at the time, which was a huge life-changing amount of money. We happen to know in a lot of cases of people who ended up at Guantanamo that they were the result of people lying about the people who ended up there, or simply mistaken identity. That's the case of another one of our clients who is still detained in Guantanamo Bay, Ahmed Rabbani. This story is actually detailed in the Senate torture report that he was detained mistakenly because the United States believed he was another man named Hassan Ghul. He was severely tortured, including techniques that haven't been used since the Spanish Inquisition. The United States eventually actually detained Mr. Hassan Ghul at the same prison, Bagram, that Mr. Rabbani was being held at. Mr. Hassan Ghul was eventually released from there, but now 20 years on, much like the situation that Abdul Latif Nasser found him in just a month ago, Ahmed Rabbani remains there. So sadly, this is a situation that we've seen repeated for a number of the men who are still detained.
And the calls have been growing for the Biden administration to close Guantanamo. How could that be done? And do you think it's likely?
Well, one of the easiest ways is to begin with releasing the 10 men who have been cleared for transfer and working to release all 27 of the men who have never been, again, charged with any crime or have faced a trial. It's unlikely that any of those men will ever face any trial. This is especially true in light of the fact that, as I think as your viewers and listeners will know, the Biden administration has announced that the war in Afghanistan is supposed to completely end by, I think, mid-August was the last estimate that they had. And I believe earlier in the show, we heard President Biden saying that combat troops will be exiting Iraq by the end of the year. That says to me, and I think to a lot of observers, that the wars that led to these people being wrongly imprisoned in Guantanamo are ending. If there was ever a right and just time to be releasing these men, this is the time to do it. The only thing that might be lacking from moving these men out of there is political will. If they haven't been charged with anything, if they haven't faced trial for anything, if the wars are over, then the question isn't what can the Biden administration do to solve this problem? The question should be, what justification does the Biden administration still have to be detaining these people?
I want to bring Gary Thompson into the conversation, the attorney who worked pro bono for Guantanamo prisoners and is the lead attorney for Ravil Mangazov, who is a former Guantanamo prisoner. Can you tell us his full story and then where he's ended up today, how he started at Guantanamo?
Yeah, thank you very much. Ravil Mangazov is from an area in Russia called Tatarstan. And he began to practice his chosen religion freely in the late 1990s. He was a professional ballet dancer, then drafted into the Russian army, and came to a point in his life where he decided he wanted to leave Russia and flee religious persecution, simply to live a life of religious freedom with his wife and then young baby. They attempted to travel south. Only Ravil made it across the border into Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and then Pakistan, where he was arrested in March 2002 by Pakistani police. And as Mark Mayer mentioned, also sold for bounty to United States authorities, who took him to Bagram, took him to Kandahar, and tortured him. He suffered extreme interrogation and supposedly confessed under duress. He was then taken to Guantanamo in October of 2002, where he suffered greatly for many years under harsh conditions and sometimes solitary confinement. Eventually, he was permitted to have counsel, which is where we came in, and we filed a petition for habeas corpus. And in 2010, here in D.C., where I live, Judge Henry Kennedy issued the writ of habeas corpus and ordered the United States government to release Ravil Mangazov from Guantanamo. If, believe it or not, it then went through a 6-year Kafkaesque appellate cycle where he was not released. And then in 2010, Revil also went through a periodic review board hearing, like Mr. Nasser that Mark mentioned, and that same panel cleared Revil for release. It then took the State Department about 6 months to locate a country for Revil to go to. He cannot go back to Russia because Russia has a record of killing or torturing ex-Guantanamo detainees returned to them. So we thought it was our lucky day when it was confirmed that Revil could go to the United Arab Emirates, where several other a dozen other ex-detainees also went. It was always Revil's dream to be in an Arab country. He learned Arabic in Guantanamo. He understood Arabic culture. He wanted to be there. And we really celebrated that day. Revil was on the last plane out of Guantanamo the day before Donald Trump was inaugurated. So it really felt like we had dodged something terrible. We were promised by our State Department that the UAE had promised them that Revil would be released in 6 months, that he would be treated humanely, that he would be given a job and a place to live in about 6 months' time, which is similar to the Saudi program for ex-Guantanamo detainees. It didn't come to pass. It turned out that the UAE lied to the United States government. These so-called diplomatic assurances were simply all lies. And Revil, along with about two dozen other men, have suffered even more in UAE prisons, most notoriously the Al Razin prison. These now 4.5 years, and they're not permitted review by the International Red Cross or Red Crescent. They've been able to get out sporadic calls to their families with the help of Reprieve, where Mr. Mayer works. The dots have been connected. We know there's torture there. We know there's mistreatment. And the men stuck in the UAE, like Revil, have all said it's worse than Guantanamo, worse than Guantanamo. So that's why with 18 men still there, we call the UAE Gitmo East, as opposed to Gitmo West. And with the numbers at Gitmo dwindling now to 39 and with 18 in the UAE, they're really a pair. And if Biden is serious about closing Guantanamo, he needs to, and his State Department needs to look into the concept of resettlement. Look at people like Revil Mangazov, some of the Chinese Uyghurs.
Gary Thompson, if I can, I just wanted to ask you about this particular issue of the UAE as Gitmo of the East. To your knowledge, what has been the U.S. government's reaction to basically offloading its Gitmo prisoners to another gulag?
Totally complicit. The UAE passed all these men off to the UAE, and as far as we know, did absolutely nothing to follow up on those diplomatic assurances. Our State Department, at least under Donald Trump, just didn't care that they were lied to. And we've seen no evidence that our State Department, even now under the Biden administration, is really doing anything to remedy the situation in the UAE. Some people in the State Department have told us they're, quote, working on it, or they're in touch with people in the UAE. But we're seeing nothing. And in the meantime, we're getting very, very scared that Revil might be rendered to Russia, or in the case of the Yemenis who are in the UAE, that their fate might take them back to Yemen, where they could suffer.
I just wanted to remind people what Joe Biden said in the last Democratic presidential debate when he was asked by PBS moderator Michelle Sindor about closing Guantanamo.
Vice President Biden, why couldn't you close Guantanamo Bay? Why couldn't the Obama administration close Guantanamo Bay?
We attempted to close Guantanamo Bay, but you have to have congressional authority to do it. They've kept it open. And the fact is that we, in fact, think it's the greatest. It is an advertisement for creating terror.
It is an advertisement for creating terror. The image of Guantanamo around the world, the fact of it. Mark Mayer, your final words.
The only two things that I would add were to kind of hone in on something that Gary was saying there. He mentioned having petitioned for a writ of habeas corpus back in 2010. That would have been during Barack Obama's presidency, and that means his Justice Department was opposing that petition for a writ of habeas corpus. We found ourselves in a similar situation with our client, Assadollah Haroon Gul. His Justice Department, President Biden's Justice Department took the same position that President Bush's, President Obama's, President Trump's did.
We have 10 seconds. What should Biden do?
He should stop opposing these petitions for writ of habeas corpus and begin releasing all of the uncharged men who remain in Guantanamo Bay.
We want to thank Mark Mayer and Gary Thompson, lawyers for at least two of the Guantanamo prisoners. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.